Slashers are justice fantasies, basically. Jade, sensing no justice in her life, she prays to Craven and Carpenter to send her a slasher, because there's a lot of justice that needs to be served.
Hello and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast featuring authors from the American West and beyond. Our funding comes from Humanities Montana and members of Montana Public Radio, and from the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. I'm Lauren Korn, talking with Stephen Graham Jones, author of My Heart is a Chainsaw. High school senior Jade Daniels is the novel's Indigenous protagonist, a slasher film fan living in Proof Rock, Idaho, where Indigenous displacement and gentrification are anything but things of the past. Stephen Graham Jones is the New York Times bestselling author of The Only Good Indians. He is the Ivina Baldwin Professor of English at the University of Colorado Boulder. Stephen, welcome to The Right Question.
Thanks for having me.
I think maybe the best way into our conversation might be to hear an excerpt from the book. Would you mind reading something from My Heart is a Chainsaw and perhaps giving a little context around that excerpt too?
Yeah, I would love to. Thank you. My Heart is a Chainsaw is Jade Daniels. She's the lone slasher fan in her little high mountain town of Proof Rock, Idaho. And her history teacher, she's a senior in high school, her history teacher allows her to write extra credit papers. And this is one of those extra credit papers, which actually has nothing to do with state history, everything to do with slasher history. These are all called Slasher 101. Her history teacher is Mr. Holmes. Don't feel bad, Mr. Holmes. Not everybody knows about the final girl in the slasher. But let me give you this blood pass. It's like a hall pass, just all the lights are off. First, and this goes without saying, final girls have the coolest names. Ripley, Sydney, Strode, Stretch, Connor, Crane, Cotton. Even Julie James from I Know What You Did Last Summer has that double initials thing going on that kind of gets your mouth addicted to saying her name. They're more than cool names, though. As you can tell by what they're called, they're also the last girl alive. But that only means she's last, maybe by luck and not best, when the actual reason she's last is that she is the best of us all. The reason she's final is her resolve, sir. Her will and her insistence not to die. She runs and falls, of course, and probably screams and cries, too. But this is because she started her horror journey out bookish and timid, with good values. The home by 9:30, good big sister type. But of everybody in the movie, she's the one with more inside her. By which I mean at a certain point in all the running away, during all the stalking and slashing, when the bloodletting's reached a sort of crazed frenzy where the bodies are just falling left and right in between, this final girl stands up through the heart of it all, through the fragile shell of her old self, and she goes toe-to-toe with this bad evil. The final girl is a hero for our time, sir. Kind of like a certain student, Principal Manx, can't really prove was me leaving that bucket of pig's blood in the rafters of the Sadie Hawkins dance that wasn't even really pig's blood. But the best ever example of a real and actual final girl is from just before dawn, where Constance finally turns to face her mountainous hillbilly slasher, who's already carved through the rest of her friends. She's had enough. Being attacked over and over, it hasn't weakened her. It's cut away her restraints. The slasher thought he was tormenting her. He thought he was the one in charge. Wrong. He was fashioning his own death. He was building the perfect killing machine. What this final girl does is turn around, scream into his face that she's so sick of this, that this is enough, that this is over. And then, in a move not matched in all the years since, not even by Sidney Prescott, not even by Slow Motion Alice when Pamela Voorhees won't stop coming at her, not even by Jamie Lee Curtis in that long dark night of Haddonfield, Constance climbs up her slasher's front side, and because she has no weapon, because she is the weapon, she forces her hand into her slasher's mouth, down his throat, and then she reaches in deeper and comes out with his life pulsing in her fist. To put it in conclusion, sir, final girls are the vessel we keep all our hope in. Bad guys don't just die by themselves, I mean. Sometimes they need help in the form of a fury running at them, her mouth open and scream, her eyes white hot, her heart forever pure.
As you said, Jade Daniels is the novel's protagonist. She's a high school senior, a bit of an outcast, and she's Indigenous too. Where did she come from? How did you conceive of her? Why or how did she become the best voice through which you were able to present your knowledge of the slasher film genre.
You know, she was not even there in the first draft of this novel that I wrote in 2013. Back then, the novel was told by a young boy in an iron mask who didn't know who his parents were. But the novel wasn't working, so I put it on the shelf for a few years, came back to it in probably 2017, right around there, because I knew that Proof Rock had legs. I knew that Indian Lake mattered, that Camp Blood and Terra Nova, that it all made a good dynamic. I just needed a way to deliver it. And I wish I could say that, like, I used some sort of writer muscles or something to will Jade up from, you know, my brain or wherever she came from, but it really feels like she just stood up from the water on her own and kind of stared us all down and said, "This is my novel now," and took over. One of the middle drafts of this novel, probably about 2018, had Jade narrating the first third of the novel, and then Sheriff Hardy narrating the second third, and Letha Mondragon, the girl Jade would cast as the final girl, narrating the third part. And Jade does her part typing on a computer during her janitorial duties in the back room of the sheriff's office. Sheriff Hardy whispers his into a dictaphone for his secretary, Meg, to dictate. And Letha speaks hers into her YouTube channel. She's a makeup tutorial star. And I passed that novel around to my friends, and that version around to my friends, and they all said, "Yeah, this is all right, nothing special." But they said they were all really sad to leave Jade's voice, that she was really compelling. But it felt like a slowdown to go to Sheriff Hardy's voice. So what I took from that was that this might be Jade's novel. So I rewrote it with Jade at the center. Not, she doesn't narrate it, but she's the focal character anyways.
I mean, in your acknowledgments too, you tell readers that the title for this book began as Lake Access Only. So there were many different iterations of this novel. What was the editing process like for this book? How did it become then My Heart is a Chainsaw? And how else, apart from this perspective shift, did it change in the editing process?
You know, so I had that version from 2013, which I didn't even show to my agent at the time. I got a new agent in 2014. We did a novel, Mongrel, together. We sold The Only Good Indians. And then I rewrote Lake Access Only with the three narrators, like I was saying, gave it to my agent. And she said, "This isn't working." And she couldn't for sure tell me why it wasn't working, but she could say that it definitely wasn't working, you know? And so I worked with her until I got it to a point where Jade was a focal character and everything kind of made sense and held together. And then she sold it to Joe Monte at Saga, and he got hold of it. And, you know, he had the usual changes. The biggest change he made initially was the Slasher 101s were probably 8 to 10 pages each, I would guess, because I wanted to say everything I could about slashers. But he and BJ, my agent, BJ Robbins, told me that this isn't your own personal soapbox, Steve. You know, you need to do things that push the story forward or reveal character. Those are your two litmus tests for every one of these. And so I had to go back and dial them back from, you know, 8 or 10 pages to 2 pages each, and which was really hard and heartbreaking, but it was for the best, I believe. Anyway, then we got to towards the end of the novel, and we were getting close to, you know, closing it, and my editor, Joe Monte, said, "The end isn't working." And, you know, I said, "Well, come on, I've been writing this book for 8 years. I know how this book ends." And we went back and forth a bit. And then he gave me a list of things that he said he couldn't let me do at the end of the novel. I mean, he didn't put his foot down, really, but he says, "These are the things that are breaking the novel," basically. And, you know, writers, we always claim literary integrity, but it probably is just stubbornness or laziness or fear, you know? And I finally decided that the best way to prove to him that my way was the right way was to go ahead and open a side file and do it his way, so I could prove to him that that way doesn't work. And so I opened up a side file and I did it as he wanted, and it worked perfectly. And I was amazed, you know? And so without Joe Monte, it wouldn't have ended as it does. It wouldn't be opening up into a trilogy. And then after we did that, and then he called me up again. He said, "Now about this title, ... which you don't want to hear those dots. You know, they're like the footsteps of doom. And I said, "Now, come on, man. You changed the title of The Alien Indians, and now you're going to change the title of this one that's been called this for 8 years now." And he said, "Yeah, that title's just not, it's not scary. It doesn't really capture Jade." And so I banged around the trails here in Colorado for probably 2 weeks, dreaming up titles, got a lot of titles down, but none of them were perfect until I just stumbled into My Heart is a Chainsaw. And I sent that to him and he said, that's it. And we went with it.
That's so interesting. And genre is one thing that I want to come back to for another question. But just hearing you talk about your editor saying, you know, this title doesn't read horror, it's not scary enough. What kind of novel or what genre of literature? Because I think that when we talk about genre, particularly when we talk about literary genres, you know, there's contemporary literature, there's like literature, quote unquote, but then there are, you know, there's all of these different kind of subgenres of literature that are maybe more or less mainstream, more or less read. So when you set out to write Lake Access Only, what kind of literature were you writing? Were you writing literature like New York Times review literature, or were you writing for horror film fans?
I was writing for horror fans anyways, and probably horror film fans as well. Back in 2013, this novel didn't go as deep into the weeds with horror trivia as it does now. It became driven or kind of, I don't know, accessorized by horror movie trivia when Jade took over, because Jade, she's like an outsider to her family, to her high school, to her community. She's an outsider of every social group she could possibly plug into. And when you're out in the cold like that, you have to insulate yourself with something. And Jade chooses slashers and slasher trivia. And that also becomes a lens through which she sees every interaction and makes us not trust her as well. So Jade brought the slasher trivia herself. It's lucky that I happen to know about slasher trivia. I'm glad she didn't do like big band trivia or something, because I would have to do some research. So it worked out well. My Heart is Glenn Miller or something. I don't know. But as for the genre I was aiming at, yeah, I was aiming not just at horror, but I was aiming at for people who appreciate slashers, who have that love of slashers as I do. And, you know, I'm talking genres and markets and marketing and all that. I wish that the bookshelf would work like the Cineplex, where at the Cineplex, if a movie doesn't have a UFO or a werewolf or an elf, that means it's not science fiction, fantasy, or horror, and it becomes drama. It doesn't become literary. Like on the bookshelf, literary is considered an indicator of quality, whereas drama is not a word that inherits quality. It just means it doesn't have those other things in it, you know? So I wish that we didn't reserve a qualifier like literary for stuff without genre elements. I think that kind of does genre elements a disservice, and it kind of pumps up literary fiction more than it deserves too. And I feel like literary fiction, it gets characterized by the best examples that it has, the Pulitzer winners, the amazing, amazing novels, whereas genre literature always gets characterized by its worst examples, you know? And I don't know how to change that, but I just wish it weren't so.
About a third into the novel, Jade is watching some girls from her high school class, and she's sort of narrating or narrativizing the scene before her for readers, I guess. One of the girls, as you've mentioned, Letha Mondragon, she breaks from Jade's narrative, what she believes is going to happen next. And you've written, the problem here is that this isn't on script. This isn't in the genre. It isn't a trope. For Halloween, my partner and I watched the Scream movies, and I found this really, really wonderful article on Vox about them, written by Asia Romano. I'm going to quote a little bit of it here because it kind of prefaces my question for you. There's a well-known idea that horror movies don't exist in horror movies, that the characters often act as though they've never seen one. While the genre is usually extremely self-aware, that self-awareness typically exists off-screen as a relationship between the filmmaker and the audience. The characters themselves don't have a clue and therefore make choices that viewers find to be extremely unwise or naive because the characters don't understand the concept of a horror movie. Scream mainstreamed metatextual storytelling and made that analytical understanding of the genre mainstream in a lot of ways. So my question then, My Heart is a Chainsaw can be seen in really a direct lineage to Scream and that self-aware metatextuality. Jade, from a close third-person perspective, is very self-narrativizing, as I've said. The events that take place in the novel, she's kind of one step ahead of the events. Why write a slasher novel, and what first drew you to the genre then?
What first drew me to slasher novels was hanging with a group of kids I hung with when I was in eighth grade who every Friday night, we'd get a stack of slashers and watch them on a friend's couch. And we just kind of fell in love. I fell in love with the communal aspect of screaming and laughing and cringing, you know? And I think horror movies work well with a crowd, I believe. They work well alone, but with a crowd, they work especially well, I think. You can get a totally different experience from a film if you see it with a packed house. So that's where I fell in love with the slasher. But my continuing fascination with the slasher, I think, just like Jade, I long for a world that's fair, that has justice. Like, slashers are justice fantasies, basically. And Jade, sensing no justice in her life, she prays to Craven and Carpenter to send her a slasher, because there's a lot of justice that needs to be served, a lot of revenge that needs to be dished out. And myself, I mean, I don't live in Jade's world, but in my world, on the news every night, I see people doing terrible things and they just kind of wave and walk away from the podium, you know? And I'm not saying that I wish bad things to happen to them, but I wish there was justice. I wish people would pay for what they do, you know? And the slasher promotes that fantasy that there is a world where everything is fair. I'm not saying that the slasher is an ideal world. The slasher is a brutal world where you can be beheaded for littering or something. That doesn't seem quite fair, you know? But at the same time, if some entitled kids pick on somebody less, I don't know, socially acceptable on the playground, then 10 years later at prom, they get theirs, and you feel kind of righteous about that, you know? But yes, I totally agree with that Asia Romano article that for the longest time, to jump genres for a second, for the longest time in zombie movies, every time the characters, this crew, whoever they were, saw people walking in the streets, dead people walking in the streets, they would scream and run away and say, "What's that? What's that?" And we're in the audience saying, "That's a zombie. Have you never seen a zombie movie? This is so weird," you know. And so there has to be this big, like, expositional arc, about two sequences long, that is these characters figuring out, "Oh, the dead are animating. They're hungry. We can kill them this way." But that can be so economized if they would just, you know, watch Night of the Living Dead or something. And to tell you the truth, horror movies where the characters have not engaged any horror media are not as scary to me, because they exist in a side universe from ours. And I think the way for horror to actually make us scared, make us more aware of our surroundings, is to promote the idea that they happen in our world. And our world has horror media. And so Scream feels like it happens in our world, whereas a lot of other slashers that don't, where the characters don't know about Michael and Jason and Freddy, feel like they happen somewhere else.
I feel like you just anticipated my question, which is what that meta-textual nature of the slasher film actually contributes to in this conversation. I guess it would be literature, to literary fiction. Yeah.
Well, the way that the character is knowing the tropes and conventions of the slasher works is it allows the characters to call them out, and almost in a parodic fashion. And the way parody works with genre is it burns off the excess. Because think of genre as a snowball rolling across the decades. It picks up all kinds of trash it doesn't need. But parody can come in and burn that extra accretion off and let the genre be lean and healthy again, I think. And having characters who know the genre that they're subject to is a wonderful, like, parodic scalpel, I think.
If you're just joining us, you're listening to a conversation with Stephen Graham Jones, the author of My Heart is a Chainsaw. I'm Lauren Korn. This is The Right Question. Our full conversation can be found online at mtpr.org, where you can also subscribe to our podcast and follow us on Facebook. What are you going to be doing differently, or what moves are you going to be making that might be different or improved in your next slasher novel?
Well, the next slasher novel I'm doing is the sequel to My Heart is a Chainsaw, which features Jade in it. And what I'm doing different, it feels like, I mean, it's already written and I'm currently revising it. It's actually due here in 20 days. But
wow.
What I'm doing different is Jade is no longer insulating herself in the same way as she was in high school. She's growing up. She's finding different ways to move through the world, I feel like. But the problem is she's in a slasher trilogy, so some of the same old things keep happening to her, you know?
She's just another Sydney Prescott, huh?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, you wrote, and I'm going to quote you now again, in a recent New York Times opinion piece, you wrote, horror is and always has been in dialogue with the anxieties and fears of its time. But horror doesn't just reflect our fears and anxieties back at us. It also helps us process them. I'm wondering if you could tell listeners then what fears and anxieties you're reflecting with My Heart as a Chainsaw.
Yeah, I think it is the absence of fairness, you know, like I guess to talk about it more generally, people sometimes ask me why I write, and which when I hear why I write, I translate it in my head to why do I hide on the page, you know, because I feel like that's yeah. what I do. And it's as easy as I'll go to Taco Bell and I'll say, hey, can I please have a chicken soft taco? And then 5 minutes later, I get a chicken steak taco. And I tell the person behind the desk, I say, you know, this is not the taco I ordered. And they say, it's all good. It's all good. But I'm walking away thinking it's not all good. I don't even want this steak taco. And that's the world I live in, the world that doesn't make sense, the world where I can't explain why I order chicken and get steak. But on the page, I can make things make sense. You know, I can explain why my chicken order turned into a steak result, you know, and that's kind of why I write. And I think that in the same way, all of us who have been part of the world, and you can't help but be part of the world for the last, you know, few years, have seen all the things happening that just don't seem fair, you know, and not facing consequences, I guess, is kind of what it is. And or not facing consequences we think they should face anyways. And I used to say that we're judge, jury, and executioner. That's not the case. That shouldn't be the case, of course. But that doesn't stop us from feeling what we feel either. And I think the slasher can allow us to engage a justice fantasy where people who do wrong pay for it, you know? And I think we all long to live in that world, even if it is a brutal, violent world. The idea of fairness is strong in all of us, I think.
Yeah, I wonder if we were to live in like a slasher world in the same way that, you know, these slasher films are actually executed, right? Like like you say, very brutal. If it would change the way we act, or if there would just be gore all the time because people aren't going to change the way they act, they are just punished for them. I'd be curious about the reality of that world.
Oh, I know. You'd have slashers like bumping into each other trying to get to people, you know, I feel like. But what I would hope that slashers and maybe My Heart as a Chainsaw can do for people, or you know what I would hope is that My Heart as a Chainsaw can get people to engage the slasher genre and just, you know, watch the screams, watch the Friday 13th, the Nightmare on Elm Street, all that stuff. And if it can make people change their behavior such that they sense the possibility that a slasher is going to stand up from their shadow, and that'll keep people honest, I hope. My dream is that we can all move through the world more compassionately, you know? And I think if we all have a Jason or a Michael or a Freddy looking over our shoulder, we're going to act a lot better, you know?
Do you feel that your dive into slasher films and horror films when you were younger, do you feel like you had that consciousness? Did it change the way you began thinking about the world?
It did, for sure. I didn't want to end up impaled on a machete. And I know it's like fantastic thinking, or maybe it's even magical thinking, but I always thought that like we have a karmic debt that we accrue as we move through the world, you know, and that can come due at any moment, or it can come due at 2 a.m. when you're walking across a parking lot, you know? And so, yeah, I mean, I'm not saying that I've moved through the world guilt-free or regret-free or any of that, but I do think that my love of and fascination with the slasher has made me a little bit of a better person, a little bit more of an aware person.
I already mentioned earlier that, like, with a slasher film, and certainly if you're following that idea with a slasher novel, there are certain tropes that you need to include in order to like fit into the genre in that way. How much of your writing process then is sort of following stereotype?
Well, it's definitely following convention, like slasher convention. Like an example would be My Heart as a Chainsaw. It opens now with those two Dutch kids stealing that canoe and going skinny dipping on the lake. That was not the original, for the longest time, that was not the opening of this novel. That came when Jade finds that phone. And then we kind of cut away and go to that scene. And that's probably 18, 20% into the novel. But Then I got to thinking about my slasher scaffolding, about how the slasher is put together, like what superstructure supports it, and that superstructure requires an opening blood sacrifice, you know, usually two people dying mysteriously, violently. So I kind of unmoored that and slid it to the front, and it satisfied the slasher conventions a lot better. On revision, I take into consideration the slasher conventions a lot more than I do in first draft. In first draft, I'm just trying to kind of get an emotional rush down on the page. But then when I come back and use my brain, that brain knows all the slasher conventions and like these 6 or 8 or 12 steps that you have to satisfy. And you can do whatever you want in between, but you've got to do this, this, and this.
One thing that I couldn't kind of help but think about while reading this was that our current culture has a very robust true crime culture, right? True crime has like taken off in myriad of ways, podcasts, books, Oxygen TV shows. Citizen sleuths are helping law enforcement solve crimes, and in a lot of cases, you know, distracting law enforcement from solving crimes. And yet rarely is anything done when Indigenous women go missing and are found presumed murdered, right? And I'm wondering what the slasher genre might tell us about that reality, right? Because we're living in this sort of like dual tension world where there's so much focus on crime and yet not on all crime.
Mm-hmm. No, you're totally right. I was just talking to my wife about this last night. We saw some headline or something about that girl who got killed and her boyfriend drove a van away. I don't really know the whole story. I didn't read it, but and I was like, yeah, I was telling my wife that there's a whole lot of Native families who are wondering, where's my daughter's documentary? You know, where's my daughter's headline? And hopefully the slasher can address that. I mean, I would love to. I don't really think My Heart Is a Chainsaw does. But one thing the slasher is guilty of, I feel like, is it makes women disposable. It just like throws away women's bodies. And I've never been quite comfortable with that, of course. So in My Heart Is a Chainsaw, I tried to make sure that the preponderance of the killings are old, established white dudes, you know? I wanted to, like, flip the table on that. Instead of the cheerleading squad, I thought, what if it was the 1% crowd, you know? And I do want to push back against, like, the disposability of women's bodies in the slasher and horror, or just in general, of course. And I think missing and murdered Indigenous women are definitely part of that, you know, that conversation, for sure. But in My Heart Is a Chainsaw, Jade being the only Blackfeet girl in town, the only Native girl in her whole county, as far as she knows, I didn't want to kill her.
There are references to nearly 200 films in this book. And for listeners who may not have read your book yet, or for those who might not be as well read when it comes to slasher films, which films do you recommend they watch to prepare themselves for your story?
Probably just the canonical ones. I would start with Black Christmas, Halloween, probably the first two Friday the 13th. Then I would jump up to Nightmare on Elm Street in 84. Then I would go to Scream. And just like you did, I would probably say watch all the Screams, because I think each one of them tells you something about the slasher. So that's probably like a total of 10 or 11 movies.
Thank you so much for being here.
This has been such an honor. I can talk slashers forever. Talking slashers with you has been wonderful.
Look for more information about Stephen at mtpr.org. You've been listening to The Right Question. The show is produced by Peter Hoag and me. I'm your host, Lauren Korn. Our recording engineer is Tom Barrich. Funding for The Right Question is provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting this program since 2008, and thank you for listening. The Right Question is a production of Montana Public Radio.